It is AD 37, and you are a small gathering of believers in a community just outside of Rome. Someone in your fellowship knows the wife of our speaker, and through her, he agreed to share his personal experience with the Lord Jesus. Let's welcome the prefect of Judea, Pontius Pilate.
Well, it's good to be with you all. Greetings to you. I'm not accustomed to speaking at gatherings of Christians, but I agreed to do this day at the request of my wife, Claudia, who counts herself one of your number. My name is Pontius Pilatus. Claudia assured me you all have a duty before your Christ to be forgiving and welcoming and loving all sinners, so I thank you for that. I do not seek your forgiveness, but I appreciate the kindness that was shown to me here this morning. I was asked to recollect for you my experience with Jesus of Nazareth. I found him to be a remarkable individual, courageous, certainly, very much like the ideal Roman in his ability to withstand great suffering, like a man. I can't explain everything that happened the day I met Jesus, but the days following were amazing. But I can tell you my part of it. I can say what was said at the time. So let me give you some background. Like many men in my position, I came from our beloved Italy. I was of the equestrian class, what you might call a knight. And I was recommended for the prefecture to Tiberius Caesar by my friend and patron, Sejanus. Now, some of you might flinch at that name, considering more recent history, but though Sejanus was ambitious, he was a capable man, and he always kept his word to me. With his help, Caesar made me prefect of Judea in the emperor's 12th year. I believe you would call it AD 26. I was the fifth prefect of Judea, following Valerius Gratus. Judea became an imperial province 20 years before I came there. The prefects of Judea all served under the governor of Syria. He was the primary authority in that region. As prefect, I had three jobs: collect taxes, keep the peace, and administer justice. That's what the emperor expected of me, and that is what I was committed to do. Judea was known as a hotbed of, well, let me just call it anti-Roman sentiments. The Jews always believed they should be an independent kingdom. Some waited for their Messiah, others took up arms and decided to make it happen right now. So I was determined, when I took office, to govern with a firm hand. Roman policy is to preserve the empire, but also respect the local customs and laws as far as possible. Respecting local customs, though, was uniquely difficult with these Jews, whose only God, there's only one God for them, he allowed no rivals and no images in their holy city of Jerusalem. So my first mistake when I came to Judea was to move the army headquarters from Caesarea to Jerusalem. Caesarea is the center of Roman administration, a lovely Roman-style city. You would enjoy it. I loved it there. But I thought the army administration should be centered in Jerusalem, at the great fortress of Antonia, which was built by Herod the Great to safeguard the temple. Of course, my soldiers marched down to Jerusalem with their standards held high before them, standards with the image of the divine Tiberius on them. Nothing unusual about that, right? Well, there was almost a revolt right there. Images in the holy city, in the temple. Thousands of Jews came to Caesarea to protest the images. For 5 days, they filled the streets of Caesarea in the administration district while we held talks. Well, I wasn't about to give in. They were a conquered people, and I needed to show respect for their betters. On the fifth day, I had my soldiers quietly move in a way to surround them. They weren't ready. I told the mob they would all be slaughtered if they didn't leave Caesarea that hour. Well, they bared their chests and dared me to strike, and they swore to a man they would die for the honor of their God. So what does one do with that kind of madness? Well, I brought the standards back to Caesarea. But I learned a lesson about the Jews. They are a stiff-necked people, as their holy book describes them. A most difficult people. I was dealing with fanatics when it came to their religion, so I had to be careful. I showed weakness in that moment, but I promised myself I would not do that again. And things were always tense after that. There were other issues, occasional riots, which I suppressed with the sword. But I know you're all more interested in hearing about Jesus than my administrative actions, but the background is important for what happened. Now, I never met Jesus until he was brought before me by the chief priests and some scribes from the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council, and that was on Passover in your AD 33. Of course, I had heard about Jesus. I know what's going on in my territory. To me, Jesus seemed pretty much like another John the Baptizer. That man John, who had created quite a following, I mean, thousands of people came to him to be dunked in water. But we watched him, and he seemed like pretty much a religious person. That was all that we could get out of him. My intelligence operatives determined that John was no threat. His work was entirely religious, dealing with matters of morality. Repent, he would go around telling people. John also attacked the morality of Herod Antipas, the son of Herod the Great, the Tetrarch of Galilee. You have your brother's wife, John told him, publicly. Such a scandal. I was very amused by it. But as long as John didn't threaten the peace of Rome, I was satisfied to leave him alone. To me, he was a peaceful outlet for Jewish religious zeal. Now, after Herod had John beheaded for some silly reason, I heard he had this infatuation, a drunken infatuation with a dancing girl. That's what I heard. I mean, the man was a fool. But after John was killed, Jesus of Nazareth became the most talked about Jew in the land. So, of course, I had my agents monitor him. We had determined he was much like John. I had one report saying that Jesus was actually the cousin of John the Baptizer. So Jesus seemed harmless, harmless enough. Not a hint of rebellion there, just another one of their prophets. So crowds followed him. They were very large, but they were peaceful. And Jesus was not the sort to inflame people with anti-Roman rhetoric. Quite the opposite, actually. So the people didn't walk away from his teaching agitated, but they came away from him more introspective, some even joyful. That was the reports that I had. There was one big difference between Jesus and this John, and that's the miracles. Jesus, report after report, he healed the blind, the lame, the mad, lepers made whole, completely cleaned by him. Those were the reports. That's what my spies told me. Jesus was also quite popular with large crowds in both Galilee and sometimes in Judea when he was down there. But he was very unpopular with the priests, which didn't bother me a bit. That was fine with me. There was no sign of trouble from Jesus as far as Rome was concerned. That was my concern. So I first met Jesus at this Passover feast in the 19th year of Tiberius. He was arrested in the early hours of the morning on Friday, betrayed by one of his own disciples, and tried by the high priest and the council of Jerusalem early, early in the morning, which technically, as far as I understood their law, was an illegal trial. But they decided he was worthy of death for some religious violation. Now, one thing Rome insists on is that only Rome has the power of life and death in judicial matters. To legally put Jesus to death, they needed my approval. And when they brought him to me, I asked the usual question, what has he done? They said, if this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you. Well, that was not an answer. And it was really early in the morning, and I wasn't in the mood for games. So telling me that, I said, take him yourselves then and judge him according to your law. Well, they explained that this was a capital case and they wanted to put the man to death. Okay, on what grounds? Well, they had quite a list I think they designed to appeal to a Roman. We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar and saying that he himself is the Christ, a king. Well, that was new. A king? Not just any king, but Christ, their Messiah, the figure they've been waiting for. And not to pay taxes to Rome? Now, if that was true, he would indeed be an insurrectionist and worthy of death. But did Jesus suddenly turn political? Nothing they said matched the reports that I had of him. So I was skeptical, to say the least, but it merited investigation. I decided to interview Jesus apart from the accusers, since these claims didn't match the records we had. So I turned and went back into the praetorium. I ordered my guard to bring Jesus to me. I noticed he had a large bruise on his cheek, so somebody had struck him already, hard. I asked Jesus plainly, "Are you the King of the Jews?" He answered, "Su leges," which means "you say it." That's an affirmation in their language. So he is a king. But then Jesus asked me if this is what the chief priests were saying or if this was my question. He asked me that. I told him this was not a claim of the Roman state. I said, "I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done?" Then Jesus tried to remove his kingship from the political realm. He said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this world." So I was getting kind of impatient with this. So you are a king, I asked him. He said, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Ah, now we have it, I thought. He is the king of another world, and has come to this world to tell us the truth. Well, that was not a game I wished to play. Now, truth, I mean, in the big sense, like the truth of the world, was for philosophers to wrangle about, not anything in a court of law, not related to judicial proceedings. Now look, I desired the truth. You know, when I was young, I suppose all men do, right? But I grew up, as all men should grow up. So here we are. We make the best of life. All the rest is opinion and speculation. That's not what we were doing here. This was a trial. I was not interested in philosophy. I looked him in the eye and I said, "What is truth?" And I didn't stay for the answer. I didn't need the answer about truth from a Jewish rabbi. I just said, "What is truth?" So I left Jesus there under guard and went outside and told the high priest, "I find no guilt in this man." The priests were livid. They started throwing all kinds of accusations against him from all directions. The main gist of it all, once again, was he's teaching against Rome, he's forbidding the Jews to pay taxes, and he's stirring up the people to throw off the Roman yoke. They said, "He stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place." So I went back to Jesus. "Do you not answer? See how many charges they bring against you?" He made no answer. No answer. None at all. I saw no fear in him. He simply was not going to defend himself beyond his earlier claim that he was not of this world. Well, he was going to die in this world if he wasn't careful, so. But then it hit me. The priest said he stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place. My friends, Galilee was not under my jurisdiction. That's under Herod the Tetrarch. That's his tetrarchy, given to him by the emperor. So the man, Jesus, was under the authority of Herod Antipas, the slayer of the baptizer. And I was not about to condemn an innocent man, so I sent Jesus to Herod. We were both in Jerusalem at the time of the Passover. The priests were not happy with my decision, but there was nothing they could do but start over and bring their accusations to Herod. So I think it was at this moment I could see just how deeply they hated Jesus. I mean, this was not a matter of justice. This was more going on. Something deeper was going on with them. Well, I sent Jesus to Herod. Within an hour, he was back, brought by Herod's guard. And he was wearing a very fine robe, some kind of mockery. Herod's officer told me that the Tetrarch was very honored to receive such a distinguished prisoner, but since the accusations were made here in Jerusalem, the case should be tried here by the prefect. He also invited me to a very lavish lunch on Wednesday. So Jesus was back, and I thought this could happen, but I did have a backup plan. There was an old custom to release one prisoner at the feast, and the people could choose who was going to be released. So by tradition, a crowd of citizens would come and ask the prefect for their choice. So they began to gather about the time Jesus came back from Herod, with the great event at the beginning of the week on Sunday. I don't know if you all know about this, but there was a huge crowd of people welcoming Jesus into Jerusalem, thousands of people. So I thought, with masses of support like that, that he would easily be the one that was released if I offered him to be released amongst two choices. But I didn't know this crowd was full of loyalists. This crowd was planned. This crowd was set up by Caiaphas, the high priest, and prepared beforehand to refuse Jesus if he was offered for release. Well, not knowing this, I offered the crowd a choice between a murderer named Barabbas and their prophet Jesus. I went to the judgment seat. I sat down in the full view of the people. I told the centurion to have the chief priests brought to me, escorted over to my chair of judgment. And as he hurried off to bring the priests, a messenger came with a note from my wife, Claudia. It was a short note, hastily written. It said, "Have nothing to do with this righteous man, for last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him." Well, now I'm thinking, well, this dream could have been from the gods. So I felt certain I needed to set Jesus free. And I would justify it by the will of the citizens through this release mechanism. So when the priests arrived, I told them plainly, "You brought this man to me as one who incites the people to rebellion. And behold, having examined him before you, I find no guilt in this man regarding the charges which you make against him. No, nor has Herod, who sent him back to us. And behold, nothing deserving of death has been done by him. Therefore, I will punish him and release him." The crowd got very agitated, very noisy. I raised my hand to silence them. "Who do you want me to release for you? Barabbas or Jesus?" They said, "Away with this man. Away with this man," pointing at Jesus. "Release for us Barabbas." I was taken aback. "Then what do you want me to do with him? The one you call the King of the Jews?" "Crucify him," they said. I shouted back, "Why? What evil has this man done? I found no guilt demanding death. Therefore, I will punish him and release him." I had been completely outmaneuvered by Caiaphas. He knew this game better than I did. All I could do at that point was punish Jesus severely and hope that that was enough. So I told my men to scourge him, the full treatment. Jesus never said a word during all of this. I actually think he expected it. Now, scourging, as you know, is brutal. The flagrum is used. It's a multi-thonged whip with lead weights in it and bits of metal and bone woven into the thongs. And so when you're whipped, the lead would brutally crush a man and the bits of bone and metal would rip a man. So all of that was going on. Harsh, yes, very harsh, but it could possibly save him from crucifixion. Now, in this case, because I called Jesus King of the Jews, my men, unbeknownst to me, I was not there, they used that to mock him. They made a crown of thorns. They pressed it deeply into his head. Besides the crown, they blindfolded him and struck him in the face, telling him to prophesy since he was supposed to be a prophet. It was sort of a game of who hit you. A stick served as the king's scepter, and then they would take it out of his hand and beat him on the head with it. I did not order that. I did not order that mockery, nor did I witness it, but legionnaires have a hard life and their humor is of the grossest sort. When they were done, I went out to the people, having ordered Jesus to be brought forth. "Behold," I said, "I am bringing him out to you so that you may know that I find no guilt in him." And he came out. He was a mess, barely walking, the crown of thorns still pressed deeply into his head. I looked at the crowd, I pointed to him, and I said, "Behold the man." And the chief priests and their followers cried out, "Crucify! Crucify!" And I was just done with them. I said, take him yourselves and crucify him. I find no guilt in him. They said, we have a law, and by that law he ought to die because he made himself out to be the Son of God. The what? Well, I stopped for a moment right there. I don't know what it was, but I had not heard those words ever used of Jesus, Son of God. It shook me. It played with my mind more than anything else that happened that morning. Who was this man? Who was he? The miracle worker, the king from another world, the one who brings the truth, my wife's dream, and now Son of God. I took Jesus by the arm. I directed him back inside. Where are you from? I asked him. I wanted an answer. He said nothing. I was angry with him now. You do not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you? You know what he said? In a calm voice, still clear, looking directly at me, you would have no authority over me unless it had been given you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin. So Jesus was telling me that my authority was a delegated one, delegated by his God, the one God. And I was accountable to him for my actions, and so were the priests. I told him to wait inside. I went out to explain yet again that there was no threat of Jesus of Nazareth to Rome. His kingdom was in the realm of ideas. He was not a threat. But they had me. Caiaphas, the chief priest, said coldly, if you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. Yes, they could twist that against me easily. If I don't do their bidding in this matter, they'll go to Tiberius and say, I let a pretender to the throne free. As if they cared about Caesar. I know these priests, they hated Caesar, but they hated Jesus more. So I took my place on the judgment seat. It was about 9 in the morning. I had Jesus brought out again, bruised and bleeding, still wearing the painful crown. I pointed to him from the chair and I said, behold your king. And that got the crowd going. They erupted in hysterical rage. Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him! I raised my hand to calm them. They began to calm down a little bit. I said, shall I crucify your king? Caiaphas, at that moment, boldly shouted. His voice covered the whole grounds there. We have no king but Caesar. How else could I take that? But yes, we will go to Tiberius about you. That was aimed at me. It was an open threat. Now let me remind you about my patron, Sejanus, prefect of the Praetorian Guard, and for many years a close advisor to the emperor. It was revealed that for years he had planned on replacing the emperor with himself and had destroyed many lives by lies and treachery. Many people were executed on his word, whispered into the emperor's ear. Sejanus, prefect of the Praetorian Guard. He was arrested in the Senate on October 18th, AD 31, just a year and a half before my Passover encounter with Jesus, just a year and a half before my patron was executed. Members of his family were executed. Close associates of his were executed. Some were executed, some were forced to commit suicide. His statues were torn down and his memory was erased. Now remember, I owe my prefecture to him. He had recommended me to the emperor. Fortunately, I had had little contact with him since I came east to Judea, but our names were still linked. So the priests had me. They only needed a word in the ear of Tiberius that I set free the king of the Jews. All that went through my mind. The shouts were continuing, away with him, crucify him. All of that. So I ordered a basin of water to be brought to me, and I publicly washed my hands, and I told the crowd, I am innocent of this man's blood. See to that yourselves. Do you know what they yelled back to me? Someone yelled very loudly, his blood be on us and on our children. Fair enough. Fair enough. I ordered Jesus to be crucified and Barabbas to be set free. And I placed a large guard around Jesus with two other men that were going to be executed who had received the death sentence. So my only victory, if you can call it that, on that day was the sign. The sign. If you've seen a crucifixion, you know that an inscribed placard is placed above the head of the condemned, stating their name and their crime. For Jesus, I had them write, "The King of the Jews." The priest threw a fit. "Do not write 'The King of the Jews,' but that he said, 'I am the King of the Jews.'" Well, they've had their way, and on this one, I had my way. "What I have written," I said. And so Jesus was crucified on my order. Now, most of the mob went with the condemned man to the place of execution, I suppose to gloat over their victory against him. They were always yelling at him. So my role was done. I thought, I went to my headquarters, tried to put the whole day out of my mind. An innocent man was dying at my command. Now, for me, it was self-preservation, pure and simple. Well, not that simple. I caved in to an injustice. Yes, it bothered me deeply. There's more that I can say about that day, however. At noon, the sky grew almost as dark as night. And there was a significant earthquake. So the God of Jesus would not let me forget what I had done. Then about 3 hours later, messengers arrived from Caiaphas that because it was the Sabbath, the condemned should have their legs broken to hasten their death so as not to violate the Sabbath. I had to laugh. The niceties must be kept. Keep the Sabbath and kill the Son of God. A little bit later, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a member of the Jerusalem Council, came to me personally. He asked for Jesus' body so he could place the body in his own tomb. I had not seen him throughout the day. He was a good man, a good reputation. I thought Caiaphas would resent Jesus having a proper burial. So I said, "Of course, yes, take him." And that ended the matter, except that it didn't. The next morning, the chief priests and some Pharisees came to see me. They found out about the burial, and now there was a new twist. According to them, Jesus had promised, prophesied, claimed that he would rise again in 3 days. They said, "Sir, we remember that when he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days, I am to rise again.' Therefore, give orders for the grave to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal him away and say to the people, 'He has risen from the dead.' And the last deception will be worse than the first." So even in death, they were still afraid of him. A man shredded and crucified. But in a season of wonders, a risen king would be the greatest miracle of all, wouldn't it? "Fine," I told them. "You have a guard. Make it as secure as you know how." And they did so, sealed and guarded. The body was secure. Now, a few days later, I returned to Caesarea, and I thought much on what had transpired in Jerusalem and about the man Jesus, that very unusual man, impressive man. But how could he be the favored Son of God and die such a death? I had no answer for that. Eventually, my main duties helped me push all those days aside out of my mind. But within a few months, there was in Jerusalem a large number, I mean thousands of people meeting in the temple who believed that Jesus had risen from the dead, and they worship him as God. These people met in the temple, but they were often harassed by the Jewish authorities. The priests and the Pharisees were the most active against what they called the way. But the movement continued to grow. That pretty much ended my relationship with Jesus and all that I knew about him. 3 years after the death of Jesus, I lost my prefecture. I'll tell you that story briefly. A fanatical Samaritan claimed that he knew where Moses hid a bunch of gold on Mount Gerizim. And he gathered a large following to hunt for the gold. So they chose to go armed, which my spies told me looked like an insurrection of some kind. So I immediately led my best troops to disarm them. Well, they decided to fight, and the Samaritans were slaughtered. Well, Samaritan leaders went to the governor of Syria, Vitellus, and complained about all that bloodshed. And he deposed me from my office. He ordered me to go to Rome and stand trial before Tiberius for being too rough. That wasn't good. So on my way to Rome, after 10 years as prefect of Judea, I'm going to Rome, and Caesar died while I was traveling there. Caligula became the new emperor. I knew him. He allowed me to go into retirement, which I did with my wife Claudia. Claudia, too, came to believe that Jesus had risen from the dead. She is one of you. And as one of you, she prays for me every day. Now, for myself, I find it hard to accept that Jesus, if he's God and a just God, could ever forgive me. I had looked him in the eye and condemned him. How could he forgive me for that? That is a stain that I have to live with, and I'll never be clean from that. However, a little while ago, through Claudia, I heard about a man named Paul of Tarsus, brutal persecutor of Christians. It is said Jesus appeared to him and forgave him. Claudia says that Paul calls himself the worst of sinners. And yet now we are told this Paul joyfully serves Jesus. So maybe I'll meet him someday. I'd like that, I think, to have a conversation with him. But please know, in conclusion, I have not forgotten about Jesus, nor your Jesus. I replay in my mind what I did to that righteous man often, and I think about him daily. Daily? Daily, you say? After all these years, 4 years have gone by. Do you really think about him daily? I do. I do. Every time I wash my hands. Thank you for your attention.